Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is this movie's kind of dull. It's Joel.
Let's just say I've got really bad old person makeup on right now for this occasion.
Yeah, the movie.
Are you surrounded by characters who do nothing?
Yes, I am also.
Yeah, that voice is Justin Harrison from the...
Howdy.
Howdy. You were on the first season, two episodes, the...
The
Shakespeare...
Udamaro and his five women,
yeah.
And Throne of Blood, yeah.
And, well, you volunteered for Miracle at St. Anna.
I wish I had received a miracle in the course of watching this, but, you know, so, I had my reasons.
So,
the reason being that I got to hear Spike Lee speak in person a few months before he shot St. Anne. I think he was in pre-production at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He talked about the process of filmmaking, about being engaged creatively, and he told tiny high school Justin to carry a notebook at all times.
Oh.
I carry a notebook at all times.
Nice.
So I've always had kind of a curiosity about this, and I walked away thoroughly frustrated because there's some really fine filmmaking in this, there's some storytelling decisions that I wish more movies would make, and there is a whole lot of dull nonsense, and then one truly baffling decision at the end of the film.
I remember when this came out, this was when I first fully was aware of who Spike Lee was. That's when I was like, oh, that's the guy who did Inside Man and Do the Right Thing, which I hadn't seen either at the time, but I knew the name. And I remember this was up until Black Klansman, this was the last one to come out near me in a theater. And it kind of killed his wide release career for a little bit.
Yeah, he spent about a decade in the wilderness experimenting, yeah. And or...
If you live in, like, a major city, you would see his movie in a theater, but if you live, like, where I live, then it's kind of like St. Anna was kind of the last one, which justifiably makes sense, because it's just kind of... It didn't do much, and Spike movies don't make money in general. But, yeah, this was just, like... I don't know. I was kind of disappointed.
Wait, now you were disappointed, or before you were disappointed?
Like watching it, it's just like this is like kind of disappointing, because it's about the Buffalo Soldiers in World War II. It's like, okay, well, this Spike should have a good grasp on this, and you would think, and then it's like, oh, it's just. It's kind of blah.
I mean, he tried to write a more personal, character-driven instead of like a general story about the Buffalo Soldiers as a whole or anything like that. I think that's
there's so much potential with the Buffalo Soldiers in this.
And instead, they're we follow four Buffalo Soldiers who survive a massacre inflicted by the Nazis and their racist-ass commanding officer, but none of them really stands out as a genuinely dimensional character. They're all given one trait, and our main character's trait is that he's our main character.
He speaks multiple languages. That's what his character is.
Well, his trait is he's mixed. He's Puerto Rican. And black.
And I wouldn't even say he was our main character, other than he's the focus in the very beginning. Because once we get into the war, he's like probably the least interesting of the. No, I guess the leader is probably the least interesting, but
I disagree with you there. He at least has some conflict going on. I'm not wild about the way his story finishes, but.
So what, Joel? Do you remember when this came out? Like, did you go see it? Did you know people who went to see this? Or
no, it was Spike Lee had fallen off of the radar for me altogether in this in the mid 2000s. Like you, I was actually a big fan of Inside Man. Mm-hmm. And that's still one of my favorites. I enjoy the weird kind of heisty holdup thing going on. But I don't think I've ever heard anyone talking about this in context other than blanket statement, it's bad. And
yeah, it's big problems for me are that it's so shaggy, but all its digressions and amblings, they do not tie together in any way. And while there are a few moments within them that are really, really good filmmaking, they mostly just make me wish that I was watching a film about that instead. Like the Buffalo Soldiers, go to an ice cream shop and run smack into a jaw-droppingly racist proprietor while some German prisoners of war are being treated very decently. And the sequence ends with our four main characters deciding that this won't stand, so they go and get their ice cream at gunpoint. It's a really terrific piece of filmmaking, one of two in the film, the other being the opening battle sequence. And the rest of it's just, vaguely, things happening that are vaguely connected to one another, but it's so spread out and so, I don't want to overuse the word shaggy. It does not come together. And some of the time we spend in these various corners of the world could very easily be spent, say, making our leads dimensional and compelling, or perhaps generating some actual dramatic tension. I remember that the trailer for this made it look like the story of four Buffalo soldiers, an Italian village who must join forces to ward off an assault by the Nazis. Now, that sounds like a tight, focused, thrilling war story.
It sounds like Seven Samurai.
Yeah, and instead we get four Buffalo soldiers go to an Italian village and just kind of hang out.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Do you want to hear something real, real disappointing about this?
Shoot.
The budget was $45 million. The box office... surprised. 9.3.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Ouch. Makes sense.
It's just like that's so much money wasted.
I mean, Justin, when you're talking about this, like, not everything is just not coming together in the story. That this is something we keep running into with Spike's more middle of the road movies. It's like we keep seeing these like little highlights inside that stuff that makes it worth watching at least. But it's like he didn't have a hold necessarily on what story he wanted to tell, like Summer of Sam is a perfect example, because that has some really good stuff in it. And then there are some storylines that I feel really attached to, especially when we were watching it, but the movie as a whole just feels kind of like a jumble of ideas he had and he threw in a bag, shook around, and told John Leguizamo to see the word come a lot. So, yeah.
And motherfucker.
Hmm?
And motherfucker. I'm coming, like, all over that movie.
Yeah.
Speaking of Leguizamo, he has a very brief appearance in the movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's a whole bunch of folks in this who turn up super briefly, and in some cases long enough for me to go, oh, hey, it's that guy. Oh, hey, he's been shot. And in other cases, it's a fairly substantial role that's interesting in light of that performer's later fame,
Like
on the...
Walton Goggins.
Walton Goggins playing the boring Walton Goggins racist, as opposed to the interesting Walton Goggins racist.
Yeah, and a fun fact about Walton Goggins in this, Omar Vincent Miller, who's Train, they are in the new sitcom, The Unicorn, where Goggins is a widowed dad who wants to start dating again, and like his friends are like, oh, you're a unicorn, you're a perfect man, but you don't want to date. And, like, one of his dad friends is Omar Miller.
Huh. Well, hopefully he gets to play a character who is not ambiguously and kind of offensively non-neurotypical.
The teasers make it seem like he's just like a suburban dad who, you know, who's too focused on his kids and needs to start digging it again. So it seems like a nice change from him being a southerner or a racist.
Yeah. And you know, we've got Joseph Gordon-Levitt as a slightly slimy reporter with truly horrendous 80s hair. I think the most egregious for me was Michael K. Williams turning up as a cowardly soldier for maybe 3 minutes of total screen time.
Yeah, it's the same role he had in 12 Years a Slave. You see him very briefly in the beginning. It's like, oh, it's Omar. It's like, oh, he's dead.
Was he big time at that point? Like, was The Wire already happening?
2008?
I think The Wire would have been midway through production, in which case it would be the acclaimed show that no one watched at the time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, I'm thinking this was very much, you know, Michael K. Williams was like, well, I need a paycheck, and hey, I get to go to Europe.
Yeah.
Not a bad deal.
Yeah. So Wesley Snipes was supposed to be the leader, but he ran into some money problems. I think this is when he went to prison.
Yeah, that would have been, like, I think, was it Blade Trinity, the last movie he did before he before he went to prison, or?
That's 2004.
What did he do? Yeah, that sounds too early.
Trinity might have been the one where that caused some of his money issues. I'd have to look that up.
Stuff come out in 2008, 2007, but it's all director DVD.
Yeah.
The Art of War 2?
Yeah.
I didn't know Sun Tzu got into the cash and sequel business.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, boy.
I'm not sure when he went to prison exactly, but you know that kind of derailed his career. I won't say unfairly, but he should come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked him in Chirac a fair amount. I know he's got I think he's been consistently working since he got out of prison. I don't think he's done anything super 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 big.
He plays Derville Martin in Dolomite Is My Name.
Nice.
Who Derville Martin was in a bunch of Fred Williamson movies and directed the first Dolomite movie, which is the worst one.
He's going to be in the Coming to America sequel? Come on.
Yeah, Wesley's coming back.
Oh, yeah.
I'm okay with that.
And I kind of wish he would have been in this movie, because Derek Luke, I don't think, is nearly as interesting as Wesley Snipes.
No. I got to say, the performances in this are by and large fine, minus the child actor. He's so goddamn shrill.
I mean, he's acting exactly like an Italian child in an Italian movie, like something. I feel like I've seen kids act like this in Cinema Paradiso. Or is that even Italian? Am I making things up?
Paradiso sounds Italian.
Okay, and like Life Is Beautiful type thing. Like I think that. He's doing, I don't even know what to do. They put a lot of things have to go on this poor kid's shoulders. Like he has to hold the movie
together.
And it
doesn't help that he like so many characters in this, he basically doesn't have an arc.
Stuff happens, and I don't know. Do you guys want to talk about like the stuff we don't like first, just so we end on a positive note?
Sure. There are two pieces in this that I think are unambiguously terrific filmmaking, but a lot of my notes are admittedly my being frustrated and/or flabbergasted. Should I go first, or?
Yeah.
All right. Well. I've talked a little bit already about how aimless Miracle at St. Anna feels, and that is present all throughout the film. We get a whole bunch of potential stories and angles and areas where Spike Lee might, you know, bring in his the focus and passion that makes his best films sing. You know, this opens with our main character, with, well, the one person who's left alive at the end of all this, watching a John Wayne war movie and,
You
know, it's being ticked off by Wayne's macho racist patriotism.
Yeah, I think it's Green Beret? I can't remember which movie it is. I looked it up earlier.
And that is one thing I really enjoy about Spike Lee's films, when his characters get a chance to dive into culture that they love or hate or just find themselves moved by in some way. But, you know, given the circumstances of the present day 1983 story, he doesn't really have a chance to talk about that with anyone. And so it just sort of flitters off into being an observation that adds very little to the film and mostly just makes me wish that Spike Lee had taken the time for it to have Hector Negron talk to a friend, you know, maybe a Buffalo Soldier he met after the events of the film, or like one of the paramedics who rescues him at the end, just someone he might have stayed in touch with from that time, to get a sense of his having a life. And instead, we're just kind of told about his life by the detectives trying to investigate why he shot this Italian guy in the stomach at the three weeks from retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And the object which we are told is of great importance to him is the head of one of the four statues on an ancient bridge that Nazis dynamited. But he spends basically no time with the thing himself, either in the World War II sequences or in the present. And we spend so little time with the head that it's just kind of like, okay, it's a head.
Yeah, like,
it's nice, I guess.
I don't think we ever see the bridge. We see, like, I think immediately after that.
No, he's, yeah. I mean, he's carrying the head when they're first walking through the, you know, the water in the beginning. So
yeah, Train picked it up ahead of time.
This is something that happened a while ago, and he's just been carrying it with him.
Yeah, yep. Like, I thought the story would wrap around, like, would they end up in that area again? Because that seems like a story thing to do.
Right, well, that's where the miracle's going to happen, right? There's going to be a miracle in this movie, right? Right? Where's the miracle?
There are a couple miracles, right?
Okay,
there are a few miracles. Only one of them, like, really reads as miraculous.
But not at Saint Anna, right?
No.
No.
I mean, the Santa Anna Massacre is maybe the most disturbing sequence in the film, and for good reason.
Yeah,
it's
remind me of Come and See. There's a sequence in that, although Come and See is far more depressing than that sequence.
Now, I count one of the alleged miracles being that, you know, Wehrmacht Grunt having enough of a conscience to try and spirit these two little kids away from the carnage.
Oh, sure.
I suppose that leads me into another one of my points. Mm-hmm. Granted, you know, this was not the case in 2008 when Miracle at St. Anna came out, but it's a really bitter pill for me to swallow in an era of resurgent, you know, white nationalism and explicit neo-Nazism to have, you know, like, this noble and sympathetic Wehrmacht officer.
Yeah, sure.
Like, if you're going to do that, we got to spend more than two scenes with him.
Right.
Otherwise, it just comes across as like, well, you know, I'm working for one of the most evil forces in human history, but I'm a nice enough guy. I read poetry.
Right. This movie sets up that he is going to be an important character, too, because there's a whole scene. This is something I do appreciate, the fact that we don't just stay with the heroes the whole time. We actually do see the villains of the movie having conversations and meetings a couple of times, which is good. Although once again, maybe that time could have spent with character development. I'm not sure. But when we see the, you know, the hard ass handing out the directions, like the first thing is you need to find the leader of the whatever the Italian.
The partisans.
Yeah, the partisans.
Yeah, the Italian partisans.
And kill them. And the other thing is you need to find this specific German soldier. It's like, oh, these are the important characters. We're going to find out. Well, kind of. Not really.
They're important as objects more than they are as characters. Right. Which really, that kind of describes every character in the film. They are pieces to be moved around in search of a resolution as opposed to like really feeling like living, breathing people who have had who have a life beyond what we are seeing on the screen.
Yeah, a big part of that is like it, when you see like the flashback when it cuts to that, it's like, oh, I guess some of them will survive. It's like, oh, it's only one of them survives, so it just feels kind of cheap.
Yeah, and you know what makes St. Anna's discursiveness and aimlessness all the more frustrating is that its first battle sequence. And I'm going to jump ahead a little to a thing I like. Its first battle sequence is phenomenal. Spike Lee lays out our players, the Buffalo Soldiers, their racist commander, the Nazi propagandist Axis Sally, the German soldiers who are really fed up with Axis Sally. You know, he sets everyone up. We know exactly where they are, what they're doing, why they're doing it. And that's it's a really, really tight, elegant piece of storytelling where we learn a little bit about everyone involved before everything goes to hell, and it feels alive in a way that so little else in the movie does.
Yeah, it certainly sets an expectation that it just does not get meet.
Yeah, no. It's just a great opening, and the rest is, I guess it's like, meant to be misdirection as to like the type of movie it's going to be, but this is misdirection.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that we already have the prologue sequence where Hector murders the treacherous partisan Rodolfo, which is, again, loaded with imagery that could be really potent if it had been developed at all. So, you know, Hector kills a traitor using a weapon given to him by someone who betrayed the Nazi cause for good. To do good, except he spends so little time with that Wehrmacht officer that's just like, well, it's a gun. He has a gun. That's nice, I guess.
I want to know the story. I want to know is, was this old man bringing that gun in every day to work just in case or something like that? And no one ever said.
I might run it to Rodolfo.
This is America. Of course, I can bring my gun to work.
Was he in a bank?
Yeah,
post office in the 80s New York. So
my grandma's older brother was a postmaster. He had some higher up ish job in like the New York system, New York post office system, and he carried a gun with him because apparently it could get a little sketchy dealing with.
People. Like I don't have an issue with him carrying the gun around, given that it's New York in the 80s. It was famously a rough time to be in that city.
It was a shithole for like 20 years, and this was like the peak of that 20 years.
Yep. And
well, if that's the case, I want a story where, oh, he's actually shot like five other people, but this guy actually, we don't know why he shot him.
Yeah, like the whole setup of the beginning feels like, oh, is this gonna be like he's a Nazi hunter or something? Like it's just kind of revenge plot line, I guess. I think I said it's about the Summer Sam. It'd be better if it were a mini series or like a limited series.
Yeah, we could take some more time to actually to know these characters. You know, we could have Hector and Rodolfo interacting more before Rodolfo, you know, kills that poor German guy and, you know, kills the leader of the partisans and runs away.
And we get more John Turturro.
Yeah. Like that's the thing. As kind of nonsensical Totoro's appearance is in this, you know, it is yet again a piece of storytelling as we follow the news of Hector killing this partisan all the way over to Italy, where the information ultimately makes its way to the adult who was once the little Italian moppet. It's energetic and engaged, and after that first battle sequence, it's just Spike Lee presents a screen saver for your nap.
Yeah. Like, this movie would be... I feel like if this movie were, like, 3.5 hours, it would be better, because there is more development of everything. But, like, having this... Having it be, two, like, just under 3 hours is, like, either cut out, like, 40 minutes, or add 40 minutes. Just, like...
Yeah,
just pick something.
It's, like... It feels... It's draggy and super rushed at the same time.
Just cut out the bookends. Like, I don't need it. I really don't.
Well, without the bookends, we wouldn't have the truly flummoxing ending. And I suppose to continue on with my issues, Spencer, you mentioned you talked about this before. Mm-hmm. Miracle at Dana is really kind of awful to women. Like, the only... There is... We meet John Turturro's girlfriend, and the movie is nice enough to her, but she's literally in that one scene, and her sole purpose is to make out with John Turturro. And our female lead, like, exists to be leered at by the sleazy soldier, whom she ultimately chooses to sleep with, and then gets slut-shamed and very graphically shot to death.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. Spike Lee is always... Always good with women characters. This is ridiculous.
I mean, She Hate Me, he has a bunch of lesbian characters. They're treated perfectly fair. Mm-hmm. Especially the WNBA players. There's no weird subtext to that at all. Absolutely none.
Yeah. And...
The surprising turn is Renata, right? That's the character's name.
That's her name.
She seems like she's a capable person. She seems like she's been staying alive with the other people. Like, she's the only one who seems to fluently speak English, right? And she can, you know, she's helping them so much. But, you know, once Spike Lee had the camera on and she's taking her clothes off, then all of a sudden she became just another tool in his box or something like that, instead of a character that it seemed like she was going to be.
Yeah. Although, I'm sure you noticed, no lesbians in this one.
Well, yeah, there was an extreme shortage of lesbians in World War II, from what I understand.
I mean, you know, what the whole attempted extermination.
Yeah.
You know, I was trying to be funny, but you just got...
No.
I was raised by lawyers. My mission in life is to ruin your fun.
Ah, excellent. Yeah,
Spike loves to throw in, like, a lipstick lesbian or two. And we've covered...
I mean, I suppose you could read the two older women as potentially romantically involved.
Yeah, but...
Oh, yeah. There was See, this movie was 3 hours and 30 minutes long, but 30 minutes was these old ladies getting on, so... Or actually a flashback to when they were younger, of course.
Yeah, to World War I, when they're getting on.
Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, and building off the fact that Renata gets treated so shabbily by the narrative, you know, for a movie that does a pretty solid job at depicting a horrifying massacre as a horrifying massacre, that last battle sequence is... I was actually a little taken aback by how sadistic it was.
Yeah.
You know, when you add in that it's not as well shot or as well composed as that first battle, it just like
I think he's.
Oh, where?
I mean, I think he's assuming we were paying attention to the town and the layout. I think they visit a lot of the places we've seen already, but he's also kind of assuming that we've been paying attention for the 2 hour plus time. To like all of that,
like we see a good amount of the town, but we don't spend a whole lot of time in any one place or we get any sense of where things are in relation to one another. So it's just like, did someone like set off, like did someone leave their Nazi bait out? Because you're just getting Nazis all over the goddamn place.
I should mention that the screenplay, not by Spike, by James McBride.
No, this was based on a novel.
But right? Yeah, by James McBride. He wrote his own screenplay to his novel.
I'd be very curious to see how this reads, because it definitely feels like some of the discretions might perhaps be a little less distracting and aimless if it were prose as opposed to film.
Yeah, this feels. I want to read a book because this heavily feels like translating the book directly. Where in a book you could do more hangout stuff.
It, like the first two Harry Potter movies.
Yeah, or like, I'm not going to say Old Man and Sea.
Here's an excerpt. Although Sergeant Bishop had seemed disgusting to Renata at first, she could not resist the way he looked at her any longer. Then they totally did it, guys. It was really sweet. Yeah, and I'm not sure the book's going to hold up.
Was it written by Stuart Wellington?
Maybe.
Like what?
Was he shredded like lettuce?
I'm shredded like a ninja turtle.
Yeah.
So like the
end. I guess that leads me to my last major issue with this film.
All right.
If you'll forgive my shouting, what the hell, Spike? What the hell is with that ending? You cannot introduce a goddamn ghost into your movie in the last 20 minutes with, at best, minimal foreshadowing. Yes, there are some hints of magical realism beforehand, but nothing on the level of the little boy Angelo's dead friend bringing him back to life and leading him to safety in the midst of this ongoing obliteration of this town. And, like, he is really explicitly a ghost. It is so far out of left field that even, granted Hector is severely shell-shocked and injured, but even he's looking at it just like, we're really doing this? Is this really the direction our story is going? It's just like, really? Truly?
See, when you're talking about the end, I thought you were talking about the reveal of the secret millionaire who's going to fix everything, which I also...
I mean, that's pretty obnoxious, too.
Yeah. But the supernatural at the end is like... Sure, I guess. Because I thought the reveal was going to be the kid had, like, magic powers. Because, like, he seemed to have some vague magic powers, and it's like, oh, the ghost of his brother?
I thought it was that the kid had died. And now, of course, he was physically seeing his brother there. And it's like, well, that kid's dead. But obviously he wasn't dead because he's a secret millionaire now.
Like, it's like, just based on the way his brother talks, it was like, yeah, he was dead. He bled out and then is like, I am the ghost of a little Italian child. You are alive again. You must live to remember all these people you barely know. Away!
Chocolate giant. Yeah.
Oh, mercy. The treatment of Train made me super uncomfortable the entire time.
Oh, because it felt like Forrest Gump a little bit?
Yep.
Yeah, there's not much to say besides, like, he's like this... like a big baby, like mentally he's like a child.
I mean, I honestly don't think he was supposed to come off as handicapped in any way. I think that it was like a result of the shell shock from the earlier scene, because I mean he seems to be with it when they're approaching, you know, wherever they're going in the beginning, and then after he gets hit pretty close near to a bomb and that like rattles him really hard. Yeah. And that's when he's like, oh, it must be a miracle type thing.
And he's the most religious one, and Michael Ealy is the horny one, and Derek Luke is there.
It's like Sex in the City, yeah.
Yeah, and Derek Luke is, you know, he's there, apparently, doing something, apparently. and Laz Alonso can speak.
Yeah. He can speak Italian, and he's a body to be there when the other three are occupied.
Wait, okay, so Derek Luke is Leonardo.
Yeah.
Michael Ealy is Raphael, because he is also really angry. He's the one who's like, I don't even know why we're doing this anymore, which is why he makes the fatal mistake of sleeping with somebody and has to be killed off, like, in a horror movie.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Laz Alonso is on The Boys on Amazon playing Mother's Milk.
Oh, good for him.
Yep.
It's a pretty good series.
I'm not going to watch it.
Wow, it's pretty good. It's
my parents really liked it, which I can understand my dad, but I am surprised that my mom enjoyed it.
It's uneven, but I think the first and last episodes of the season are great. In the mid and everything else in between is definitely varies. But Laz Alonso, seeing him in this, like, oh, he was kind of scrawny here, and in The Boys, he trying to look like The Rock, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Mother's Milk is see, I've read a bunch of the comics, and I just find them so distasteful that I'm not interested.
I think that's kind of the point, that they're distasteful.
Yeah.
Yeah, Garth Ennis deals pretty heavily in
distasteful
in squick, as it were.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Although his World War II comics, to tie in, are consistently a lot more focused and a lot less juvenile than his cape work.
Right, because he's super serious about that. He's a big World War II buff, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, who was it? John Robert Burke? No, Robert John Burke has a brief part, and he's in some other Spike movies. He's in...
Oh, you mean RoboCop 3?
Yeah, RoboCop 3, and he's in... Black Klansman. He's the chief of police.
Yeah.
And he's in Venner, the terrible Stephen King movie.
You mean the excellent Stephen King movie.
Oh, and I believe Robert John Burke is in a bunch of Hal Hartley stuff.
I thought you were going to say he was in a bunch of Gossip Girls, which he totally is.
You know, don't you like Hal Hartley?
I've only seen the one movie and it made me want to tear my eyeballs out. So,
okay.
Yeah. All I know is that he directed an adaptation of one of my favorite mystery novels and that he was a very well-regarded director who had severe substance abuse problems, which ultimately killed him when it seemed like he might be getting himself back together.
Oh, Hal Hartley's dead? Oh, I feel bad now.
I'm pretty sure he's dead, yeah.
Rest in peace.
Yeah. Like, so I think that like about covers the things I dislike about Miracle at St. Anna. It goes nowhere. It does nothing. And when it does come to life, it is a vision of a much better movie. I think if we had, advertising is advertising and all that, but if we had gotten like a focused siege picture, like the trailer suggested, or if we had spent, more time in the United States with our protagonists in training and dealing with vast systemic racism while preparing to go and fight a war, or, even if it was just these four dudes trying to survive after the unit gets wiped out by friendly fire, yeah. There are any number of Miracle at St. Anna's in any number of parallel universes that are good movies because they found something to build on, and instead it's just kind of like Spike Lee opens up a duffel bag and everything inside is the movie.
It's... I don't know.
Like, his dirty sock being the way he treats women.
Yeah, that's normal.
Yeah.
It's not the, like the love triangle of Derek Luke, Michael Ealy, and Renata. I'm not sure how to say her name. It's all really Italian-y.
I think it's Renata.
No, the actress's name.
Valentina Servi.
Their whole love triangles is kind of. I mean, it's just an excuse for nudity.
Yeah,
Like,
and
there's no
I.
getting around it. It's just for the purpose of, hey, you want to say you're naked? Now you can.
Yeah, and like I just do not understand why her character is attracted to Michael Ealing's character, because like he's playing a really loathsome dude.
Yeah,
Like,
he's just too horny. That's his problem.
I mean, if you've seen like other Italian movies, like I feel like that's what the way the guys act in Italy, though. Just
Yeah,
like
Michael, yeah.
no shame hitting on people. Doesn't matter what age they are. It doesn't matter, if they're with somebody or not. That kind of thing, like that. That's not an excuse, but it. I don't think this is her. I don't think that she necessarily would have been unattracted to him because of how gross he was being,
I mean,
unfortunately.
like he has like lean man roles and I guess like you say black movies. I don't know what else you'd really call them, but I think he's been in some Tyler Perry stuff, and he's like always shows up as like the hot light skinned black guy and things all over the place.
Michael Ealy?
Yeah,
He's the best man holiday.
and he's in an Underworld movie. I saw at work the other day.
Really?
According to IMDb, apparently he's in Too Fast, Too Furious.
Yes, he has an afro. It's really great.
Yeah, he has blue eyes, which is kind of freaky.
I mean, the movie Too Fast, Too Furious kind of stinks, but it's great to see him in that. Anyway, he's going to be in a remake of Jacob's Ladder that's
I
coming out this
just
year.
saw that.
Yep.
I mean, I like Michael Ealy when he shows up and stuff, but here's just kind of like he's actually, from what I've seen, actually do acting and not doing not just like being like handsome on screen. And
Yeah.
I think he's good at being like kind of the sleazy.
Yeah, it's a good performance.
It's
It's
just
just
wasted in a movie where nothing really happens. I mean,
yeah,
things
I mean,
happen.
we don't know anything about him other than that. That's
No.
the whole thing we keep talking about. I mean,
I think like the most we learn about any character is the leader of the partisans and the treacherous partisan,
yeah.
and most of that comes from one scene.
Right, yeah. Let's talk about the flashback within the flashback, at least. How did you guys feel about that when they were still on U.S. soil, I believe, or it must have been because it was like in the South, right?
The ice cream thing
Yep.
when they're in like
Yeah.
they're in Louisiana, I think.
With that one famous actor whose name I'm drawing a blank on.
Yeah, that it's a great sequence, and like it like the what leading up to it is kind of like this kind of painful dialogue of like, hey man, racism sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah. John
Yeah.
Hawks, right?
Yeah, and
Holy shit, that was John Hawks?
Yeah.
I am not used to seeing him with straight hair.
Yeah.
Oh, John Hawks was really good in Too Old to Die Young.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I
Yeah,
haven't watched it yet.
he kills pedophiles and rapists on that show. It's great.
Nice. I need to check that out. I'm a Refn fan, so.
Me and Sarah just watched Small Town Crime, and it is a pretty damn good movie. Like, he's a detective, kind of. And he plays alcoholic really well in it, and I kind of wish they were going to make some sequels. That's how much I enjoyed that one. It's not usually how I feel about it, but
And he was terrific in a really like really dreadful macho sleazeball movie called Too Late, which is it's what happens when you get a dude cinephile who wants to make a crime movie and he wants to shoot on 35 millimeter and he wants it all to be five lo single long takes, and he's never talked to a woman.
You're just talking
Hawks is
about us.
Hawks is phenomenal in that, but it's would like to be able to, decent Lockman's in it, and she's both it's a good performance, and she is a very pretty person who spends a lot of time wearing very little clothing. I'd like to be able to say, oh, hey, it's Deacon Lockman, and she's, you know, scantily clad, and that's fun. And it's just like, movie, your sleaze is getting everywhere. Just,
yeah.
Like, mop up after yourself, please.
Yeah, I'm looking...
But it doesn't.
I'm looking through the cast of Miracle, and I forgot Kerry Washington shows up for one scene.
Oh, yeah, no. Surprise, lawyer.
Oh yeah, yeah. The I suppose we should talk about the ending, wherein Hector Negron, having lived what we're told is a fairly happy life in the wake of World War II, a long marriage that ended with the death of his wife, blows away Rodolfo when they meet again by chance, is looking at life in prison, and then. A heroic corrupt attorney bribes the judge? Yay?
Yeah.
Does she bribe or does she blackmail? I think she says something like...
She basically says, like,
if you want to be elected to this other position.
It's both a bribe and blackmail.
Oh, okay.
Like,
yeah.
Like, if you let this dude go, we'll help you. If you don't, we will bury you. And Hector is taken to a beautiful beach where he is as confused as the rest of the audience is. It's just like, I'm okay dying. I just want to see my wife again. And then it turns out that the entire thing was paid for by the little boy Angelo, who has grown up into a silver fox. And they hug, and it's a tearful reunion that would be a lot more powerful if they had bonded at all.
Yeah.
Because, he spends his whole tragic time with Train and not Hector. And so it's like, why this?
There is a way that could work. They are the only two to have survived this intense traumatic experience, and that would be bond something that created a bond, especially considering their parting was as weird and mythical for them as it was for the rest of us.
Because I think the only real true action they had was Hector had a radio, and he's like,
well,
it ain't working. And then
only one who could translate what he was saying too.
Hector is the one whom he confides in about Rodolfo being bad news.
Oh, yeah. I watched this a week ago and I kind of forgot some stuff from this.
I took notes.
I took notes too, but I still look at my notes like, I don't remember these things in this movie.
It's because he's walking around with that notebook all the time.
Thank you, Spike Lee.
did you guys notice the cameo happening in the background on the beach? Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman were working on a boat together. No, I'm just kidding. I just couldn't help but think of Shawshank. Like, come down to Mexico and meet me.
Yeah. I like how Walton Goggins dies, because
his death is phenomenal.
It's a great shock, because he's been a real racist piece of shit the whole time.
I'm Walton Goggins. I'll get it with everything. Is blown up by Nazis immediately.
Yeah, he gets in his truck, and it's like, oh, and it just blows up. And I had to rewind it, wait, did he just die? And
yeah. And then there's, that whole weird thing where the highest-ranking black officer in the unit is bad for some reason? He's portrayed as a sympathetic character up until they reunite with our four protagonists, and suddenly he's this spineless flunky.
I mean, we're supposed to assume that he's been being pulled through this crap and like everything was going to be better because when he gets there, they've got this German soldier, and that's the only thing that they you said you have a German soldier. Okay, we're going to come. Otherwise, we wouldn't care if you lived or died. Like, okay, maybe things will, change positions. Maybe we'll have some better luck. Oh, the German soldier's dead. Yeah, you guys, what the fuck, kind of thing. But, there's the hat turn. Yeah, I don't.
I don't know, like acting wise, like Spike can get good performances out of people, and the acting is all around good, except for the kid. That's kind of a weak link, which he can't really help because
I kid, like the kid.
He's fine. He's not like you know Rosetta or Jury Smollett.
You're comparing it to the fucking cream of the crop here.
Okay, fine. He's not as good as the other Smollett from the movie we covered.
Imagine him replaced with the kid from Last Action Hero instead.
But I don't know.
I mean, I was like, if you replace like with like the little kid from Looper.
Oh sure.
Or like his Italian equivalent. Yes, his role ultimately turns out to be this strange, magical, realist, heightened thing, but he's just so broad and so shrill. It reminds me of the worst parts of the actor who performed Tiny Tim in the Alistair Sim Christmas Carol, which is kind of like my gold standard for obnoxious child acting. In places it's a very fine performance, and other places it's just like, kid, you are rotting my teeth.
Oh, see, yeah, I don't know, it just didn't strike me, like, because I hate children actors for the most part. Like I have a really hard time getting won over by any kid actor.
You did,
like, in general.
You did in movies we've covered so far, except for this one, I guess, maybe.
Yeah, you mean didn't like the kid actors?
Yeah, like Rosetta was good, and Yves Vallu, and the kid in Pelle the Conqueror.
That was a stellar. These are stellar kids movies. We're picking those ones out here.
Yeah.
But like I can't think of anything recently. But I can be very irritated easily by child actors.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe I just wasn't. I think something about the language barrier usually makes it harder for me to think, you know, a certain level of acting is good or bad. It's harder for me to tell.
That's fair. And like that brings me to one of the things I did really like about Miracle, that, you know, we are hearing folks speak in their native languages. You know, I love when movies, especially movies that are big and international, allow the world to be as big and vast and diverse as it is, and be it, you know, in the race of the cast, in their ethnicity and sexuality, in language. There are some really terrific decisions made in Miracle at St. Anna that are just squooshed under the constant nothing.
Yeah,
it's a good movie.
It's worth one watch, maybe. I don't see myself watching this again for a long time.
With that ending, I do not see myself ever revisiting it. I am glad to have seen it, and I'm glad to have had a chance to talk about it with y'all, but of the Spike Lee films I've seen, it's easily the weakest. And, like, you know, even something as... I ultimately liked Chirac. There's a lot of stuff in Chirac that really doesn't work, at least for me.
Oh, we're going to get to that in a few months, actually.
Yeah, like, Chirac consistently feels energetic and alive in a way that St. Anna never does. It's dreary.
Yeah, it is.
It definitely is.
It's like really wallowing and like, isn't this war depressing? Which it is, but at the same time, it's a movie you can kind of play with tone and play with, you know, the narrative a little bit to make it, you know, you can still have the reality of it, but it can be more peppy.
Yep. I think that there's something special about the movie, because I never expected... I forgot this movie even existed, so I didn't expect to see Spike Lee filming any sort of military movie at all, basically. So, and when it, you know, we do have military actions going on in this movie, there's a lot of things to appreciate, like, especially in the context of, like, other World War II movies, stuff like that, like, things that he was inspired by, and so on. So, I don't think this is, I mean, She Hate Me is so much more of a worse movie than this.
Yeah.
But this is probably... Like, when it comes to, like, starting at the bottom of the list of the movies we've covered, probably She Hate Me, then Miracle at St. Anna, which is a close to Summer of Sam, you know,
yeah,
for the bottom three.
Yeah, I'd say the same thing. She Hate Me at least has more stuff to talk about.
Some of the things you described to me, I
CGI sperm.
No.
Yeah, I don't think I'd watch that sober, but
it's
two and a half hours. You should watch it just because you're gonna wonder how the hell this happened.
Yeah,
and that's probably the best thing. Like Miracle of St. Anna, you can kind of be like, oh, this is a mess and kind of boring. She Hate Me is, and this doesn't make it a better movie than Miracle of St. Anna. At least She Hate Me is like a train wreck.
Yeah.
Yep.
And invite some friends over, tell them it might be a little homophobic and problematic. And if they're okay with that, be like, okay, we're going to watch this batshit movie that, man, it's a baffling mess. I
have subjected my friends to the Italian animated Titanic movies, so... And somehow I'm still friends.
I mean, that's a so bad, it's, you know, like, you should be have fun making fun of it. I don't think She Hate Me, you can really have fun that way.
And I wish We Hate Movies would cover it. I think that'd be a good episode.
Yeah, let's call it in for the listener request.
I will.
All right, sure.
Yeah, but...
I will do that.
Yeah.
Once I've had a chance to see it, so I can actually know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's streaming. It's available. I just don't know how many people are going to pay to watch it.
No. You got to buy the DVD like I have and listen to the commentary.
Oh, dear.
I was very excited to see that Spike Lee had commentary for She Hate Me. Like, really? Of all the movies? Okay.
Yeah. So, before we get to other 2008 movies, what are your guys' favorite World War II movies? That are better than this movie, or at least
Big
have more
Top
things.
Pee-wee. No, wait.
More things to talk about.
I brought it up in the pre-recording conversation, but a recurring thought throughout my watch of Miracle of St. Anna is, I really wish I was watching Overlord right now. Now, it is by design a far more fantastic film, and the fantasy doesn't just involve the mutant Nazis running around. It takes place in a world where apparently American systemic racism is less powerful, since the main character is a black man in an integrated unit, the likes of which never existed in our world. But that is how you do a tight, thrilling World War II action movie. Even if you strip out the mutant Nazis, there's a whole bunch of really tense, well-filmed war scenes and, you know, overwhelming odds stacked against our heroes are clear and present and constantly feel threatening in a way that the vague mass of Nazis in St. Anna just never really feels, until it's like, and suddenly there were a bunch of Nazis. They murdered everyone. Now, Giovanna Adepo does a really fine job as a soldier whose courage lies more in wanting to save lives than in killing people. Wyatt Russell is, I think his work in Overlord is up there with his dad's work at Snake Plissken for, like, scary cinematic anti-heroes. The mutant Nazi effects are grody and enjoyable, and a whole bunch of Nazis get incinerated. Can't complain about that. I would really like to sit down and watch The Big Red One at some point, but in terms of something I've actually had the chance to watch, it's very much a how World War II happened film, but Rainer Werner Fassbinder's Berlin Alexanderplatz, the notoriously long television series, which follows this sad petty criminal in the waning days of the Weimar Republic, as we see how Nazism took hold in people's minds. And our protagonist himself never goes around waving a swastika flag, but he is precisely the sort of bitter and calloused person who would respond to fascism. And, you know, it's not an easy watch, both in terms of the time commitment and the fact that it's just like, well, here's a long, slow drain into horror. But in examining the whys and hows, it's second to none. So, yeah, mutant Nazis and pre-Nazis for World War II.
All right. I'll try to be quick with mine. Turns out there are quite a few I really like, but I'm going to keep it to my top two. Ivan's Childhood, the first Tarkovsky movie. It's the experience, based off the book. It's about this like 12-year-old boy who worked for the Russian army during World War II. And it's kind of his experience during World War II. And it's beautiful and horrific, and it's Tarkovsky. It's his easiest movie to get into. It's no Stalker or Solaris. It's easy to process, and if you want to show someone Tarkovsky, you know, show them this one. It's a great intro to his work. And the other is the Czech New Wave film Closely Watched Trains. If you have seen it.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. First off, I know the Nazis are a stand-in for the communists. It's very nakedly clear. Because, like, during Czech New Wave, they use a lot of Nazis in place of communism to criticize the government. But besides that, it's a hilarious, like, teen sex comedy wrapped up into this, like, World War II story.
I remember the ending being really morbid.
I mean, he dies at the end, but he does save the day, and like it's like a weird metaphor for like him finally having sex with a woman. It's like it's with like a huge explosion. Like it's I mean, that's what I was kind of trying to get at, and it's and him trying to lose his virginity, and like he I don't know how to explain it besides, like, it's a sex comedy mixed with a World War II story, and it's really worth watching.
It really is. And it's also worth noting that it's quite a stunning film visually, at least if my memory holds up correctly.
Oh yeah, the photography and, like, the framing, it's all beautiful. And it knows when to be funny and when to not be funny. And you just get a good glimpse of, like, this was like to be a teenager. I just realized both my movies are about teenagers and World War II, and what's like to live during that. But, yeah, it's a Criterion DVD, and I think they're both Criterion DVDs.
Mm.
And Come and See, which is a classic. But it's fucking brutal. Anyway, Joel.
It's visually stunning. Yeah. It'll blind you forever. Two World War II movies. Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS. No, I'm just kidding. I was just looking at Captain America. That's not going to be my pick either. So a movie I've talked about before, I can't remember when this came up, but the movie Canal, which is directed by Andrzej Wajda, the guy who did Ashes and Diamonds, and apologies for that pronunciation. Polish movie.
Okay.
And it's such an intense movie. Like, these resistance fighters. I'm just going to read the description here because I can't really explain what happens in the story. During the last few days of Warsaw Uprising following World War II, a modest group of resistance members remain. The band must take refuge in the sewers under the orders of a leader, Zadra, but it's only a matter of time before they will have to emerge. So basically, this group of resistance fighters are just trying to find a way to get out of this sewers alive, and there's still Nazis above, you know, cleaning up the last of the people every time they think they might be safe. Not to mention people who would be more than willing to point out resistance fighters so as to save their own asses. And there's many scenes where they're poking their heads up and like, it might be safe, but it might not. You know, people die, of course. Their minds get involved. Like, this might be booby-trapped things. Yikes. Like, I can't describe how thrilling the entire movie is. So I can't recommend Kanal enough. And the other movie I'm going to pick is Robert Bresson's A Man Escaped. It's a very slow-moving, methodical movie all about this French resistance fighter, I guess they're the only, like, resistance fighter movies, who plans his escape from an encampment, a war encampment that he's locked up in. And you see him meticulously counting out the days. He's figuring out the guard schedules and stuff like that. You see him carefully making the equipment he needs to escape. And when he does, at the end, when he pulls off his escape, once again, thrilling. You're holding your breath going like, oh my God, is this going to happen? Bresson films everything so well. Like, can we stop recording so I can go watch it right now? Is that... No? Okay, never mind. Anyways. that's A Man Escaped.
Oh, okay.
And you've actually, Joel, you've actually reminded me of one that I think I would take precedence over Alexanderplatz, Jean-Pierre Melville's Army of Shadows, which is based on Melville's actual experiences in the French Resistance, mm-hmm. and follows a band of resistance fighters at the height of Nazi occupation of Paris as they're gradually whittled down to nothing and still persist because the only other option is unspeakable.
Yeah.
Like, it is bleak as all get out.
Yeah, Melville, I believe, actually was a resistance fighter. Or he was associated with them.
That's what he said.
Okay.
At the very least, he did some writing for them, and I think he may have actually been involved in, like, active operations of some sort.
And I think he would put he also, like, hung out with criminals and shit, and he would put criminals and, like, resistance fighters in his own movies to make it more authentic.
And there is a sequence in Army of Shadows that features maybe the most heroic and decent thing I've ever seen someone do in a fictional film.
Mm.
Wherein an attempt to rescue a captured resistance member has gone very badly. The person who came in to save him has been thrown into the same cell. His friend has been beaten to the point where he'll live, but not well, and that's entirely the purpose. So his would-be rescuer offers him the cyanide that was meant to spare himself from excruciating pain and death by torture, knowing full well that he's condemning himself to excruciating pain and death by torture, just so that his friend won't have to suffer anymore. It's astonishingly decent, potent.
Yeah, so
Inglourious Bastards.
You just remember that one?
Inglourious Bastards?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
And of course, The Man Who Killed Hitler and then The Bigfoot, my second favorite film of the year.
Mm-hmm.
But I digress.
Yeah, I've seen some Nazi exploitation movies, and they're kind of trashy, grindhousey stuff that I don't think too many listeners would give a shit about. So I'm not going to recommend those to anyone. All right. Other 2008 movies that you recommend?
2008.
Yeah. Yeah, I got two.
The Year of Hancock.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, I'll try to be quick with mine. One is The Strangers, the Brian Bertino horror movie. I never got to see it in theaters because no one wanted to go with me. So I saw it on DVD later, and I loved it. It's a... I guess it's kind of torture porn-ish. I don't know. It's very minimal, and like it's just this tension of these three strangers raid a house for no reason, and they terrorize people, and it's really terrifying, and it feels kind of real, even though it's outlandish. And if you watch horror movies for kill count, you'll hate this one. But because at the time, my friends hated it because they love the Saw movies, and only two people die, so this movie sucks. And I was like the one person who really liked it because like there's a jump scare that's genuinely well paced and placed, and just like the tension is like, you know, like they're going to die at the end. Like you just kind of figure that at some point. And Dennis from It's Always Sunny has a very small part in it too. Sex, Okra, and Salted Butter, the Muhammad Salah Haroon TV movie. It's part like culture clash comedy and like it's about a African family who are living in France and trying to deal with the living in a different culture where like everyone has adjusted except for the father, and the father is just trying to get used to like how his family around him is like totally fine with like French culture, and like his wife leaves him for a white man, which is a big storyline. And so it's kind of part like sex comedy, part like fish out of water comedy. It's deals with like LGBTQ stuff, and certain African countries are more homophobic than others, and it kind of gets into that. It's like this. It's only 80 minutes, so it deals with a lot in a very short time, and it's just if you like Haroon, or I think it's worth checking out. I think it's just on YouTube for $2, but the video quality isn't very good.
All right.
There's that. Oh, and I talked about it on Flixwise Canada this year on an episode, so you can hear me talk about that more if you go to Flixwise Canada. I think it's like episode 31 or 32.
That sounds like a film I might have watched in my undergrad days. We had a professor from the Sierra Leone who did a course on gender and sexuality in Francophone film.
Hmm.
Seriously neat stuff.
Yeah, it's a pretty good movie, and generally really funny.
Joel, you want to go, or should I go?
I'll go. I want to talk about The Brothers Bloom. Just kidding.
you bastard.
No. So I was looking for, usually I talk about the other movies that I covered on the other podcast, Please Don't Send Me in Outer Space. We actually have only covered one, and I would like to talk about that anyways, because it's probably criminally underseen. It's called Wrist Cutters, A Love Story, starring Patrick Fugit, Shannon Sossaman, and Tom Waits, who's always a pleasure to find. Oh, speaking of John Hawks, I forgot he was in that. Wrist Cutters is kind of a bad title. The movie's like an afterlife comedy where these people who have killed themselves end up in this weird purgatory. And the thing about the purgatory is it's almost exactly like regular life, except for things are just a little off. And
there are no comfortable couches and no one can smile.
Yeah, and then your car has a black hole underneath. Or if you accidentally drop something, you will never get it back. It's got a charmingly funky song that becomes an earworm because they play it all the time. But hold on a second, let me. Sarah, what's the name of the band that does that? Go-Go Bordello does the song. And that's just a part of things. So I can imagine people be driven away from it because it is kind of that one of those like quirky, also dark comedies. But I really like it a lot. I really like the jokes. I like the existentialism of the whole thing. And so I recommend it. Wrist Cutters, Love Story.
Yeah, it's based on an Israeli short story by Edgar Caret, I think.
Ooh, I didn't know
also
that.
Had. Yeah, I think the original short story is called Pizzeria Kamikaze, or it's called Neller's Happy Campers. Pizzeria Kamikaze is the pizzeria where Patrick Fugit's character works.
Right.
And it's also the title of the graphic novel adaptation, which I remember having really, really striking coloring. They used a whole lot of, like, silver. I mean, this might be an improper use of the language, but, like, silver gilt.
Mm-hmm. Like, it, gilded in that way, you mean, like, right?
It like, reflective silver.
I think gilded means gold, but yeah, I wonder.
Yeah, I think gilded is gold, but...
yeah, I know what you mean. That's crazy. You're blowing my mind here. I didn't know there was an adaptation.
Yeah, and... I mean, they kind of obscured it. Like, Caret, I don't think he's super well-known in the U.S., and, you know, it was... They didn't change a lot, but the main character was, well, Israeli in the original short story.
Right.
Pretty much everyone was, so.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a little bit of race trading on there. That's unfortunate.
Well, not nearly as bad. I think it's like, I do not know Patrick Fugit's ethnicity or creed.
He's black.
Really?
You can't see me doing my rapid blink thing that I do when I'm being sarcastic, but yes. yeah, I don't know either. What was I going to say? I was going to say something.
Dark Knight.
Oh, does the short story or the graphic novel have a part where Tom Waits' character is spritzing a turkey with a water bottle?
I do not recall that. I definitely think that. The movie expands on the ending of the short story a little bit, goes a little further. It's been years since I've read it, but I believe the short story ends when Tom Waits and company bust up the cult.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, there's a fair bit added in the adaptation.
A little bit of twist turn around there, I see.
Yeah.
Anyways, that turkey spritzing scene is one of the best pieces of cinema that you could ever see. So, yeah, you should watch that movie, listener. The other movie is a documentary, James Marsh documentary, Man on Wire. It's all about Philippe Petit, who is probably the only famous tightrope walker that anyone can name. And his big plan is to walk between the Twin Towers. And this is in the 70s here. Like, he was intending to make a tightrope line and walk between the Twin Towers. So the documentary is a lot of reenactment, a lot of interviews with the people who were involved in this particular escapade. And it is... I keep saying the word, but I guess this is my bag. It is so thrilling to see how it all gets played out. The people telling the story are really good at doing this. I mean, you can tell Philippe has told this story 100 times. So, but when everything goes down, like there's actual documentary footage of him being on this line between the Twin Towers. It's insane, and it's a wonderful documentary. I haven't seen the narrative film with our star of Miracle at St. Joseph, Gordon-Levitt. So
his hair is better, I think.
Ah. It's the 70s. He hasn't got the 80s hair yet.
It bears repeating that Joseph Gordon-Levitt's hair in Miracle at St. Anna is truly horrific.
I better remember him in a movie.
He was the reporter.
Oh, I remember that, but like besides that, I don't remember like what he did exactly.
Nothing. He did nothing.
Okay.
He insinuated himself onto situations.
Yep.
Okay. So, that's it, Joel?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm done. Yeah. Yeah, Justin.
Okay. All right. Okay, well, I'm actually super excited that we're doing 2008 because it is the year my favorite movie was made, Rian Johnson's The Brothers Bloom. Of the four films he's made so far, it's I think the least well known. You know, Brick put him on the map. Looper was fairly successful for a mid-budget non-pre-existing franchise science fiction film back in 2012, and The Last Jedi is The Last Jedi. Brothers Bloom kind of got dumped by Summit Entertainment because they realized that the quick cash-in adaptation that commissioned of Twilight was in fact going to be a cultural phenomenon, so they redirected all their money towards that and, you know, reaped the rewards there, but kind of hung out a really wonderful movie to dry. It is a movie that could take place sort of any time, any place. It's ostensibly contemporary, but no one drives a car from the same era. People travel by steamship, and everyone's fashions are sort of timeless 20th century. Mark Ruffalo and Adrian Brody are two con men brothers, the Brothers Bloom. Ruffalo wants to write the best con in the world, a con so perfect it becomes real, and Adrian Brody wants to not betray people for a living. He's very sad. So, after trying to get out and mostly just getting really, really drunk, Ruffalo tracks his brother down and offers him one last job. They will con the beautiful, reclusive heiress Rachel Weisz out of her fortune. In the process, she'll get to have an adventure and leave the home where she spent her entire life. Their right hand operator is Rinko Kikuchi, who it's an almost entirely dialogue free role. She is working primarily through facial expression and explosions, and it is a film that bounces between high comedy and rather intense drama, both personal and in term and external. There's a pretty great standoff at the very end, and in the process you get a really solid meditation on the way storytelling works on the people telling the stories. You get Mark Ruffalo doing maybe the best work I've seen him do as, well, someone who is pushing himself to his very limits deliberately and in loving it the entire time. And you have a really, really, really wonderful romance between Adrian Brody and Rachel Weisz. It is charming and sexy and feels genuine and alive. Plus, the score by Ryan's cousin, I think? His cousins work on a lot of his films. Nathan Johnson is just terrific. It's very breezy jazz, the sinister undertone. I can't recommend it enough. I want more folks to see it. And with Knives Out coming out this year, you know, now's as good a time as any to check out what the director did beforehand. Seriously, I will shout that movie's name from the rooftops.
Yeah, that's, I think, the only one I haven't seen yet, except for the one that's about to come out this year.
I've got a copy on DVD.
I bought it on DVD and Blu-ray because that's the kind of dweeb I am. And my second 2008 feature is the Wachowski sisters' Speed Racer, which, caveat that it stars Emil Hirsch, who has in the year since proven himself to be an utter weasel of a human being.
I forgot that was him.
Yeah, he's a good actor. He's a crummy person. But Speed Racer was flambéed at the time, used as yet another example of how those pesky Wachowski just can't live up to the promise of the first Matrix film. And in the years since, people have gradually realized that, one, the Wachowski sisters were always awesome, two, they really missed the point. Speed Racer was one of the first films to use digital effects as intensely and as, you know, blatantly as it does. From the cars to the world around our protagonists. And rather than try and aim for realism, which would make the fakery all the more apparent, the Wachowskis go full Technicolor live-action anime. It is bold, it's primary, And it, you know, 11 years on, there's something that looks quite like it. And amidst all of the gorgeous, goofy action, you get a pretty wonderful little story of a family coming to terms with the way they've let each other down and the ways that they love and care for one another, and a rather scathing critique of capitalism. Like, to the point that the villain actually sits Speed Racer down and gives a lengthy speech about this obscure economist and how he's going to ruin his life by basically setting the entire market against him. You know, there is an annoying little kid and an annoying pet monkey, but gosh, if the good doesn't totally outstrip the bad.
I mean, who's more annoying, the kid in Speed Racer or the Italian kid in St. Anna?
Tough call. I'm going to say the kid in St. Anna just because he seems out of... his performance seems out of place with the rest of the film. Yes. As irritating as the kid in Speed Racer is, it's very much of a piece of the rest of the film.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the thing. The whole, I mean, once you get like involved with the whole cartoon world, it's hard to see that character as an annoying child and not just like a cartoon character, which, I mean, that's the amazing thing about the movie. Like people say like, oh, this movie's like a cartoon. Like, no. Street Racer, the movie, is like a cartoon.
Speed Racer,
a live action cartoon. Like, they did it right.
Yeah.
I guess I'll finally watch it.
It's worth it. It's worth it.
I would say this is a weird thing. Like, the first time I watched it, I watched it on digital. And, like, speed is a big thing about the movie. Like, things are moving fast in there, and like digital just can't keep up with that. So I would recommend getting a disc of it.
Yeah,
for like, you probably get it for like $2, I swear.
I'm sure it's on on Netflix. Yeah. DVD.
Yeah, it at least it was back in 2014 when it was one of the last movies I watched at my undergrad before I finished up there. I think it might have actually been what I watched when I celebrated finishing my massive year-long final project. But yeah, The Brothers Bloom and Speed Racer. Those are my two 2008 films I'm recommending.
All right. Yeah. So, Justin, thank you for coming on and talking about Miracle, even though there's not as much stuff to talk about, it turns out.
Well, the movie was crummy, but your conversation was fantastic. Well,
thank you. But so, do you have any upcoming articles or anything that Birth, Movies, Death, or any other places?
I'm gonna have a few pieces that will likely be out by the time that this episode goes live. I'm currently working on a piece about the way that music works in Jamie McKelvey and Kieran Gillen's Music is Magic comic Phonogram, since, you know, there are a few ways you can do that. You can tie it to a very specific piece of music. You can invoke the images that music videos have, which the first and third mini series of Phonogram do. But the second one, which is set across one night at this club in Britain, and each issue takes place from the perspective of a different person over the course of that night, that uses motion and color to invoke not necessarily a specific piece of music, but the sensation of listening to and being swept away by music. It's super, super cool, and it's a type of medium exploration that makes me love comics. And in terms of a longer term project that will likely still be upcoming when this episode goes live, I'm also going to be putting together a big retrospective on that same creative team, McKelvey and Gillen's soon to wrap up comic The Wicked and the Divine, which asks what happens when you get 12 brilliant, flawed, problematic young people, tell them they're gods and give them godlike power in 2 years to live. It's been a hell of a ride. I've followed it all the way back to 2014 when it first started. So there is definitely an aspect of sentiment in my wanting to delve into it. It'll be the first series that I was there from A to Z on. But I'm also really, really intrigued by the ways that it explores the nature of creativity and what it does with the mythologies of the deities these young people are told they are.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's pretty seriously good stuff. Also, possibly cursed. For context, two of the gods we meet are Lucifer and Inanna. Lucifer takes her style from David Bowie's Thin White Duke era, and Inanna owes his look to Prince, the point that he materializes in a purple rainstorm when he first appears in the comic. Thing is, I want to be careful about how I word this, but both of those characters exit the comic violently at points. In both cases, those exits happened in the immediate wake of David Bowie's death and then Prince's death, to the point that when it happened, when Prince died, Kieran Gillen, the writer, was like, I believe he actually said on Twitter, okay, I'm genuinely kind of creeped out now. Fortunately, none of the other people who inspired the deities in the comic have dropped dead, so possibly not cursed, but certainly a little bit of eeriness there for you.
So, Joel, what episode will be out? This will be early-ish September.
In the Mouth of Madness coming out.
Oh, hell yes.
That's the only one we have, directly, or already in the, what do they call that when it's done?
In the can?
In the can, thank you. Yeah, there's a can, it's in there. We all really enjoyed it, but we've been basically enjoyed all the John Carpenter we've covered, which is six, which was surprising to me, and we haven't even covered The Thing yet, so there's... Anyways, In the Mouth of Madness is a pretty damn good movie. So, yeah,
the last good one, I think.
Yeah, I was looking at that. That was like, Escape from L.A., which some people do like. I personally hate it.
I've never seen it. I love Escape from New York so much, I kind of don't want to see the sequel.
Yeah. There are parts of L.A. that work and parts that really, really don't. Terrific ending, though. I'll give it that. I'll go to bat for parts of Ghosts of Mars, but it's definitely a pretty weak film.
I wouldn't bat for any of that movie. Well, I guess Pam Grier, Jason Statham. But I don't want to watch it a second time.
That's fair. That's fair.
And Vampire. Vampires? They want James Woods.
Vampires, yes. I hate. Hate that movie so much.
Yeah. You know, I'm just glad that, you know, in his older age, John Carpenter seems to be a pretty happy dude. You know, he's making music with his kid and his godson and producing comic books.
Yeah. He's doing what he wants.
Yep. All
right.
If you had a chance to see him live, do so. He's a phenomenal. It's a great show. It's a great, great show.
Yeah, and he's like, he's in his 70s, right?
Yeah, he 80? Is. No, he's in his early 70s, I think. Maybe mid.
Yeah, still got one. That's something. But, what's coming up for me? I'm slowly getting back into updating my site, Jailhouse701, Japanese Cult Cinema. Just kind of depression, and the summer sucks the energy out of me. So I'm slowly getting back into that. I think by this point I might have a couple more reviews. The entire Legends of the Poisonous Seductress series reviewed, and only three movies, and my favorite Seiji and Suzuki movie, Gate of Flesh, which I believe is on the Criterion Channel. I have the the Criterion DVD, and it's basically Golden Girls, but what if it was post-war Japan and they were prostitutes? And it's a great, crazy Suzuki movie.
And that sounds like something I'm going to have to check out, yeah.
I think it's a good Suzuki to start with. That or, like, Gerald, the one you like a lot.
Huh?
The Suzuki movie.
Take Aim at the Police Van?
Yeah, that or Tokyo Drifter. Those are, like, good ones to start with.
I mean, there's the thing about Suzuki is you're going to have a hard time finding a bad one in the bunch.
Yeah. And, like, the plot doesn't matter to him. He kind of never gave a shit about plot. It's this kind of like craziness for sake of craziness, but it works for some reason. But yeah, so a Suzuki review will be up and some other stuff, and that's it. The next episode, the second half of the 2008 pairing, is The Class, the Cannes winner from 2008, which is on Amazon Prime and other places to rent. I have not seen it. I don't know anything about it, so we've had good luck with the Cannes winners.
I want to say that something sinister is going on in that film, but that's almost really conjecture on my part.
Yeah.
In The Class?
Yeah.
I just know, I think it's a French movie. I saw it one can, like, and that's about
like,
it.
There is a French film about a class of kids where something sinister is going on. I don't know if that's the one or not.
Well, I guess we're going to find out.
There's probably a bunch of movies that fit that.
Well, Raw, for instance.
What the?
Yeah, but if that doesn't work out, then we might do Slumdog Millionaire. But I hopefully it will still be available to watch on streaming. Yeah, so check us. Come back for that. And Justin, thank you. For coming
on. Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, at Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell. And thank you for listening.